Welcome to Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with John Pemberton. As a physician interested in the social determinants of health, Dr. Pemberton began his research career with a study of childhood nutrition in England in the 1930s. He later explored such topics as air pollution, coronary artery disease, and lung disease. Dr. Pemberton is best known for co-founding the International Epidemiology Association and for his devotion to social and environmental health issues. He died in 2010 at the age of 97. This interview was conducted by David Gunnell in 2005.
Many thanks for taking the time to talk to me about your career. If we could start off...
Have you started?
I have started, yes. Few people start their careers with the intention of becoming an epidemiologist. Can you describe what was the path, or what's your own path, that brought you to epidemiology?
Well, I think it's a combination, really, of an interest in medicine itself and my political interests. As a young medical student, I was very influenced by friends who were socialists and became, in fact, a socialist. And I joined the Independent Labour Party, which wasn't the most left group. Of course, that was the Communist Party, but next to that. And at the same time, of course, I was studying the medical subjects. And began to relate medicine to the wider world of politics and legislation and that sort of thing. In my second year, the famous hunger marches march took place from Jarrow to London, and a group of us who were left-wing, decided to meet these hunger marchers. I think it was at Wembley, somewhere outside London, and see what we could give in the way of first aid, and to show our support for that. And I was naturally impressed with the hard conditions which these men were demonstrating against, and in particular the very low rates of unemployment benefit. And I think as a result of that, I decided to write an article linking nutrition to the unemployment benefit. And the British Medical Association, in I think about 1933, published a diet which they said was adequate and affordable with the amount of benefit the unemployed were entitled to. So I wrote this article called Malnutrition in England, which was published in the University College Hospital magazine under that title, and in which I tried to demonstrate that the unemployed could not purchase the so-called adequate diet which the BMA recommended with the money available from unemployment benefit. At that time, our teachers, I think by that time, 1933-34, I was in my clinical years, so our teachers were all consultants hardly treat specialists, and taught us, of course, on the patients in the teaching hospital. But they never, as far as I recollect, mentioned the social conditions of these patients, anything about their nutrition, housing, jobs, and so on. It was all a question of how to make a diagnosis and then discharge the patient with a letter to his or her doctor. So the other thing that was going on at that time was the efforts of the Socialist Medical Association, which consisted of doctors, was founded in 1930 and held meetings to make the public more aware of the relationships between bad social conditions and ill health. So I became a member of that group, and as I say, we organized meetings, usually quite small meetings, public meetings, to try and put forward these views. There were one or two doctors who did support this social approach to disease. Two I may mention. One was James Spence, who became the first professor of child health in the UK, in Newcastle, in around the late 1930s. Now, he carried out a study in Newcastle in which he showed that the children he saw privately were taller, heavier, and had higher hemoglobin concentrations in their blood than the children he saw in the hospital outpatient clinic. That impressed me very much. It was done in figures. I won't say it was statistically very convincing, but sufficiently convincing to show there was a difference between these rich and poor children. The other man who influenced me especially was Boyd Orr, later Sir John, and then Lord Boyd Orr, as he was. And he was in the mid-1930s carrying out surveys of children and feeding experiments with extra milk, and was beginning to show the close relationship between income and nutrition and health. And so when I had the opportunity, after qualification, of joining Boyd Orr at the Ryatt Research Institute, Aberdeen, to do a survey, I jumped at the opportunity and enjoyed and found most interesting and stimulating the two-year survey of some 4,000 children in different centres in the United Kingdom from 1937 to 1939. So there was a handful of distinguished doctors who were seeing, what I would say, seeing the light. I mean, seeing the relationship between living conditions and health, and adopting a scientific approach to that problem to demonstrate it to the public and to the politicians that it required political action to remedy such problems as malnutrition, appallingly bad slum housing, and unhealthy conditions at work. So that's how I got into this conviction that by studying populations, apart from treating individual patients, but by looking at the whole population and seeing what differences were determined by income, for example, one could get throw light upon some of the major illnesses at the time, which included, of course, tuberculosis, as well as heart disease, cancer, and these other things.
So as you describe it, your interest in population medicine and epidemiology began prior to you completing your medical studies. Did you move straight from your medical studies into working in population medicine epidemiology, or was there a period when you carried out and your work was more clinically orientated?
Well, of course, I completed my studies, became qualified in 1936, and in order to become a consultant, and to do fairly well in those days, one had to do hospital house jobs. Then they were available only to those who could afford not to take a properly paid job, whereas today, of course, they're compulsory for every young qualified doctor. So I did the usual house jobs, as we call them, of house physician, house surgeon, obstetric house surgeon. So that took up, I think, only about a year or a year and a half. And then I saw this advertisement for the job that Lord John Boyd Orr wanted to fill, which was clinician to a team of research workers to examine these children scattered about the UK. So yes, it was pretty soon after I qualified that I got a job in what I was interested in, nutrition, and that within the general complex of social medicine.
What's the biggest difference between epidemiology as it was practiced when you started your career and epidemiology today?
Well, at that time, we're talking now about the late 1930s, epidemiology meant the distribution of infectious disease and its prevention by inoculations and sanitary law and so on. So we didn't think much of that aspect of epidemiology when I was a student and young doctor. We thought that was the concern of the medical office of health, and they did a rather boring job of seeing that the laws of public health in regard to water supplies, housing conditions and so on were obeyed. So we didn't connect with epidemiology at all, I would say, in the 1930s. And then a key year, I suppose, one would say, was 1942, when the first professor of social medicine, John Ryle, was appointed to Oxford University in the UK. Of course, there had been, as I said, a small group of doctors, one or two distinguished ones I've mentioned, and 50, maybe 100, not particularly distinguished, who simply felt, because of their political convictions, that a social approach to medicine was required. So the word social medicine, the term social medicine, came into use among our group rather than the word epidemiology. And it wasn't, I suppose, until, after the end of the war, when the discussions for the health service and so on were going on, that we began to think in terms of populations. You see, social medicine could be interpreted as a concern of the clinician for the social conditions of his patients. And that is the road I think I was following at that time. The social aspects of clinical medicine rather than epidemiology as we know it today.
Okay. Collaboration is an essential part of successful epidemiologic studies. What have you found to be the most important ingredients of a good collaboration, and with whom have you had your best collaborations over the years?
Yes, perhaps before I go on to that, I should just finish off what we were saying, and if I had to pinpoint it, it would have to be to about 1946, 47, 48 in the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, where Bradford Hill was first senior lecturer to Major Greenwood, who was the first professor of epidemiology in the University of London. But his epidemiology was this infectious disease type. But when Bradford Hill came, the idea that you could apply studies to non-infectious disease became current. And that is when Richard Dow and Jerry Morris and John Nolden and others came back from the war, took their DPH at the London School of Hygiene, were influenced by Bradford Hill, and got into the practice of looking at populations, comparing populations, and applying through Bradford Hill statistics to those studies that epidemiology as we know it today in the UK became manifest. So in a way there was then a sort of wedding between those who just thought of social medicine as the social aspects of clinical medicine and those who thought of it as a study of disease and society. So I'm sorry to have gone back a bit, but I hadn't quite completed where we got to in how we got through social medicine into epidemiology.
No, I'm sorry for interrupting you, and I think that's a very nice description of what was happening in the 1930s and 1940s. And I think to try and to tie up that question and thinking about the environment and the way in which epidemiology and social medicine was practiced in the 1940s and seeing how it is practiced today in the 21st century, what do you see as being the big differences between how it was then in its formative years and how it is practiced nowadays?
Well, one of the biggest differences is the size of population that we chose to study in the late 1940s and 50s. Now, in my case, when I became the head of the Department of Social Medicine in Belfast, we took populations of 500, 600, 700, 800 for study. And the reason we did that was because a social research worker, and it was often a social worker who did this sort of research, visiting people's houses, collecting data in a face-to-face interview. And I suppose we realized that we couldn't do more than 500 or 600 in the course of a year. And so that became a sort of standard figure. Now, of course, we didn't, in those days, recognize the interference of so many confounding factors. Sometimes we did allow for one factor, for example, tobacco smoking, cigarette smoking, or obviously for major differences like sex and age. But we were very unsophisticated, and the other point was that in our small academic departments, which started, as I said, from 1942 onwards, in these small departments, there were only five or six workers, a professor, senior lecturer, social worker, and perhaps one or two other assistants, and computer in the old sense of using machinery to do arithmetic, which what it was really. So there were small little teams in academic departments, five or six people, samples were about 500 or 600 or 700, and some quite good studies were done. Then Richard Dahl, in the great cancer, cigarette smoking, he did in fact take a much larger sample, all the doctors on the register, which I think was some 20,000. But even he did not allow for lots of possible confounding factors which the modern epidemiologist would take notice of. And so to deal with all these confounding factors, you seem now to have to take not hundreds but thousands or even tens of thousands of subjects for the statistical purposes. That you were asking me the differences. That was one of the differences. Sheer size, really. Research was based on small departments or social medicine units, research units. And with not unlimited time, and certainly not unlimited populations, but very small ones.
Collaboration is essential to successful epidemiological studies. What have you found to be the most important ingredients into a good collaboration, and with whom have you had your best collaborations?
Yes, this is, again, a very interesting aspect. In a way, we weren't very concerned with it because, as I said earlier, most of us worked in small groups, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 sort of people, like the social medicine unit of Jerry Morris, for example, pneumoconiosis research unit. And so, and with a clear head of that department. And so, he or she obtained collaboration by helping to appoint or appointing people who had similar interests or could easily adopt similar interests to the head of the department. So it was, it went without saying that collaboration wasn't a problem. There was very little inter-university collaboration or inter-unit collaboration, and I would say practically no international collaboration. So that's a very big change which has occurred. Question of scale of operations and scale of individuals, or number of individuals available to carry out that research.
Any within those constraints and the understanding that collaborations and extensive collaborations were less frequent in those days, are there any particular collaborations or projects that you worked on jointly that stick in your mind as being the more enjoyable or most productive collaborations?
In my own experience, I don't think there were any collaborations on a sort of equal basis, like one university department collaborating with another. But you had to get collaboration, of course, of the factory owners if you were studying bisonosis, as I was, in factories. So you had that sort of collaboration, but not, I think, the one you're referring to of professional collaboration. Perhaps we did in fact get the advice of a statistician later on from a department of statistics, but that's not quite wasn't quite collaboration on an equal basis.
or any individuals you particularly enjoyed working with over the years, any scientific colleagues?
Yes.
Whom you've worked on?
Well, the ones I've enjoyed working with are usually the ones I appointed in the university. Peter Elwood, one of the best examples, who was proved to be such a distinguished epidemiologist. He did his postgraduate work with me. But I don't think that's the sort of collaboration you're referring to today.
Who would you regard as being the two or three most important epidemiologists during your lifetime?
I'm afraid I'm restricted here to the UK because although I've had the pleasure of working with international people in the last part of my career, and the ones I've got to know best and appreciate most have been UK. And with that proviso, I think there can be no doubt that Richard Doyle would be in the top small group. His work is so well known, and it's really, I think, his meticulous, conscientious approach to data and research, but also, of course, working with Bradford Hill, who introduced the stricter statistical approach, which produced a wonderful combination. And then I would certainly include Jerry Morris, for his work in the social medicine unit. And Medical Research Council Social Medicine Unit with Titmus and others. Jerry's original mind, and again indefatigable efforts on his book on uses of epidemiology, I think made a great contribution. I mean, his book was a sort of guide to those of us who were starting courses in social medicine or epidemiology, because he sets out there all the possibilities and a lot of the results of epidemiological research. So those would be very high in my estimation of that period of time. I'm not really qualified to speak much after, say, 1970. 1976 when I retired, but the massive amount of work done by the Bristol Social Medicine Department now is obviously making a huge impact on epidemiology.
Turning now to yourself and your own research program. What do you think has been your most influential paper? And what has been your most underappreciated paper?
Yes. Well, of course, the answer to the second question is all of my papers, but leaving that on one side, I think, of course, in all our departments, we were often requested to carry out a particular piece of research by the government or the Medical Research Council, some influential body prepared to put up money in that way. And in Belfast, in Queen's University, Belfast Department of Social Medicine, the government asked us to look into the question of bisonosis among Trax workers, because at that time, I'm talking about the 1960s, Trax bisonosis was not recognised as a disease qualifying for industrial benefit. but it was recognised. Bisonosis in cotton workers was recognised in England, the rest of the UK, apart from Northern Ireland. So the government asked us to find out whether bisonosis occurred in flax workers. That is the basic question, and I had an excellent team within my department, or we may have appointed one or two for it, including Peter Elwood, who did a great deal of the work. And we examined the flax workers in 18 out of 19 of the linen factories in Northern Ireland. The only one factory which refused belonged to one of the ministers of the Northern Ireland government. So we were able to demonstrate that bisonosis did occur, certainly in the early stages of flax processing. And it resulted in a Northern Ireland government report called Flax Bisonosis, I think, or Flax Bisonosis in Northern Ireland. We included one or two factories in England so that it could be added to the English law. So it added three little words to the legislation, and these three little words were "and of flax," following the reference to cotton bisonosis, so it's cotton and of flax. So I could say that did have a little bit of effect in the legislation, but I couldn't say it. Now, you ask about the work recognized.
Appreciated.
I always think of a paper I did when I was worked as the medical registrar in the Royal Hospital of Sheffield was not appreciated as it should have been. I followed up 300 patients from the medical outpatients, consecutive patients that I'd seen in outpatients consecutively, and followed up again a year later, and I found that 20% were dead, another 20% were cured, and 60% still had the disease for which they came up in the first place. That was one finding, and I don't think until that time people had ever really looked at how much good or not good you do when you see medical outpatients in a big teaching hospital. And the other interesting point was that I think it was 40% we classified as psychological or psychosomatic. I think most general practitioners would not be surprised by those figures, but certainly at that time, that sort of examination of what the results of our efforts were had not been made.
Where were those two pieces published? First of all, your flax paper.
The flax paper was in the government report, from Blue Book.
Okay.
And the other study of the follow-up was published in The Lancet.
Why do you think the Lancet paper didn't have a big impact? Any thoughts?
I think it was distasteful to clinicians to realise that they weren't doing so very well after all.
Okay. I'm thinking about how you've set about the research questions that you've asked, what's led you to select particular research questions? What's led your research agenda?
Well, sometimes, as I said, it was a request from the government or some influential body. I can't remember the others, actually, but certainly from the government. Money is a very important factor in research, and of course, when somebody or some institution offers you money to do a particular study, that's very tempting. And when it's the government itself, it's difficult to refuse if you're the only university in that case, Northern Ireland. In other respects, in those days, the head of a department of social medicine, he was very much the determining factor in decisions of that sort. And if he was interested in doing something, well, then the department would organise to do it. When you get a bigger department, of course, then you get sub-departments and sub-studies going on, and that is more fruitful. But when I was working in Belfast at this time, Dr. Frank Pantridge introduced what he called mobile coronary care and made out a good case that he was saving lives by sending a doctor and nurse in an ambulance to the place where the coronary had occurred and administering electrical shocks and treatment within a very short time of a coronary occurring. And so I was interested in finding out how long people survived, or rather, how long people who died of a coronary had survived, to see if it's practicable to get an ambulance to them in time to do any good. And so we did a study, I can't remember, 900 or so, I can't remember the numbers, time after coronary of death, really. And we found that half the male cases died within 2 hours, or maybe 2.5 hours, and the females was four and a half hours, that sort of figure. So I think the question is still unanswered. As far as I know, it's unanswered. My final conclusion was that you did save a few lives with a thing like the coronary care ambulance. And of course, nowadays they don't have to send a doctor out, but they send a highly trained medical technician who presumably does the sort of thing that Pantridge advocated. So that was my own idea, because of my association with Frank Pantridge, to see really whether it was worthwhile. How else did we decide on things? Say now, I think in the whole of my career, when I was not head of a department, one just joined a unit because either you liked the man or admired the man. For instance, during the war, well, I was lucky then because Hans Krebs was working in Sheffield and working on nutrition on conscientious objectors. And he wanted a clinician to join in. And so I was fortunate in getting that. But that really wasn't my idea. It just happened to coincide with my interest.
Okay. Which of your contributions to the field would you most like to be remembered for?
Well, I always say that I never made important discovery in medicine myself, but I think I did bring together a lot of people who did. And we did that, of course, I was co-founder of the International Epidemiological Association in 1955, And I think that association has been successful and has led to collaboration and considerable advances in epidemiology in a lot of different countries. I think I was just very fortunate at being interested in the right thing at the right time, because when we founded the, I founded this, my co-founder was Harold Willard of New York, and we didn't, we found that there, although there weren't many departments of social medicine research workers in that field, there were a few, and they were multiplying. It was not fashionable, isn't quite the right word. It was the time had come for epidemiological research to develop. And I should have emphasized earlier, of course, the research we were interested in and founded the association mainly for was research into non-communicable disease. Epidemiology of communicable disease, of course, was highly advanced and had been highly successful. But nobody in the 1930s, or hardly anybody, thought that those methods would be sensible in the study of non-communicable disease. But our little group did believe in that, and we did bring people together in national and international meetings to give papers and to discuss research and to collaborate. So that's the only thing of any significance, I think, that I have achieved, and that was largely a matter of good luck, good fortune.
That's a very important contribution, I think. Outside of epidemiology, what have been your major interests in your life?
Yes. Well, I've always been interested in sketching, painting, going to galleries, looking at pictures. Reading. I've read much more literature since retiring than before. And I have done a bit of writing. I wrote the biography of Will Pickles, the country doctor who made some original epidemiological observations in general practice, and another much shorter biography of the chief warden of the National Trust. So I enjoy writing. We've all written articles for the medical press. What else? Oh, walking, hill walking. It's always been a great pleasure. I love the countryside. And family. Of course, my late wife and three boys who are great, great experience, great joy. That's about it, I think.
In your opinion, what has been epidemiology's most important contribution to society?
Well, ruling out, we mustn't forget the great contributions of the epidemiologists of the infectious disease period, enormous contributions in prevention of disease through inoculations and through improved sanitation and nutrition and all the rest of it. So I suppose you're really referring to the period of the epidemiology of non-infectious disease. It's difficult to pinpoint because there have been enormous floods of light thrown on cancer, of course, through epidemiological methods. Cancer of the lung and cigarette smoking is the outstanding example, and also the work of Jerry Morris and the understanding of the causation of heart disease. There are lots of others too, but those come to mind predominantly, I think, with me.
What's your assessment of the current state of health of epidemiology? And what are the biggest risks, in your view, that our profession faces? And what are the ripest opportunities for us?
Well, I have quite a few. Well, first of all, I think it's in a very healthy state. The way it's spread in so many countries now, and acknowledged as an important research tool in medicine, is indisputable. I think it's a pity. Well, it seems to me there is not so much cooperation with clinicians and clinical problems as there was. And when you think of it, the coal face is really at the sick person, or in our case, the sickness in a population. And I think clinicians in the early days often indicated to us what were important problems for them, and ideas maybe about causation. So I think perhaps we've declined a little bit in our cooperation with clinical medicine. I think the resources for epidemiological research are limited, and obviously a tremendous lot of interest has been put in the molecular side of disease, and more recently the genetic side. Getting the target, in a sense, is getting more and more small in relation to the total target. The total target being the health of the whole population. And I'm not impressed with the results, all the possibilities of improving the health of a population by research on genetic problems. I think we're all concerned of the paucity of research workers in epidemiology. I mean, that's a relative term, because there are a lot of people working in epidemiological research, but there's such a tremendous number of problems to be attacked. That's why I'm a bit concerned that such resources as we have are not too much used up on unpromising, or what I regard as unpromising, channels of research. And one, as I've said, perhaps this is a bit unorthodox, because I know there's a great enthusiasm for genetic research now, but I don't think it's got too much to offer to epidemiology, which after all, by definition, is concerned with populations. So that would be one comment. Oh yes, the other one is a major concern too, and that is the enormous amount of effort which is put into health service research. Now, this is a very important subject, and of course the stimulus largely came from Archie Cochrane in his book about efficiency and inefficiency in the health services. And of course it's something which government is interested in, because it's a way of delivering good services at a lower cost. And that is obviously important. But again, it's not really epidemiology in the sense of studying disease in a population, or not as I see it. So it's almost a separate discipline altogether, health services research. practical, important subject. But it's not going to discover any causes of disease. That's what I think our main goal should be. A minor concern is the frequency of meta-analyses nowadays, because I still find it difficult to believe that you can amalgamate 8 or 10 different studies and be confident that the criteria used in those studies have been the same. So those are just some, not my, they're really major concerns. Meta-analysis is not so major. I would like to see, I thought that Dolan Hill's study of cigarette-smoking lung cancer was a great model, and I can't see why the same model is not repeated for studies of some of the modern epidemics, under which I would include obesity. And there's tremendous interest in obesity now. There should be a lot of research money. But why not do a Dolan Hill study of doctors in relation to obesity? Another epidemic now, in which we seem to be powerless against, is depression. Depression seems to be getting commoner, and nobody seems to understand its causes or how to prevent it, and yet it is a big problem. Some opportunities for epidemiology, which have never, as far as I know, been exploited, would be the extension of epidemiological research to other social phenomena, crime, for example. I mean, when they have been done, those studies seem to have shown that the treatment of crime is unsatisfactory, prison leading to further admissions, for example, and the prevention of crime is obviously not very successful either. So I would think there is a channel there where epidemiological research might be very productive. I would like to see a subject introduced into the school curriculum, perhaps not under the title of epidemiology, but on some title like risk measurements. How do you know a treatment's any good? How do you know whether commercial product's any good? What information is it based on? I think we should try and make our 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds more analytical, more skeptical about the things that are told them by the advertisers ad nauseam, and of course also by some of the professions too. Though much less so in medicine, I think that is an aspect of medicine which has improved enormously, the reliability of what doctors say and the honesty with which they say it. I don't think I've got much to add, really. a sort of dream that came to me was that there should be an Institute of Lifelong Epidemiology, which would no doubt start with this year's babies, but could start with, say, 20-year-olds, because you'd probably have good birth data about those, and then follow the populations, successive populations forward. And of course, an institution is almost immortal, unlike research workers who get interested and die or lose interest. An institution, you have it in some sense in national statistical productions, where but it needs focusing and an institution for under some such heading as lifelong epidemiology might be a great advance. Well, that is speculation.
Do you have any, while you're speculating, do you have any predictions about what the future might hold for our field?
Well, I just hope that some of the standard experiments, but the research should be continued on a wider basis. And my prediction, I suppose, must be that this science, this basic science of medicine epidemiology, will be more and more accepted in all the countries of the world. There are 190 countries in the world, and I don't know what percentage don't have any epidemiology at all, but there must be a lot of scope for extending this science in some of the countries, of some of the poorer countries, and indeed some of the richer countries too. So it's difficult to predict. I suppose as governments realize that this could save money in the end, they will promote epidemiological research more and more. It's a minefield, really, because when they have done that, it hasn't always been successful. No, I haven't any very clear predictions.
What would be the single most important piece of advice that you would give to a new epidemiologist starting out on their career?
Well, I think he should pick on some disease, accident or congenital defect, or that he finds particularly interesting, and study that in detail on his own. But I think he should also apply for a fellowship or a research job in a good unit of epidemiological research. There are difficulties, of course. First of all, he won't necessarily know which are the good units, but I think by reading the International Journal of Epidemiology, he could probably find out where good research is going on, and then to try and get a job under some well-known epidemiologist. That's the best route, I think. Yes. Presumably this young fellow or young woman have become interested in epidemiology and see the scope and the excitement of researching in that way. And then they should ask themselves, well, what particular problem is there, or problems which could benefit from epidemiological research, and could I get into such a problem? Could I get into a unit where I could research on such a problem? Or is there a unit already concerned with that problem in which I'm interested in? But basically, the advice is, after getting full medical qualifications, of course, I mean, maybe one or two additional things, like the member of the community medicine diploma, but then to search around and ask around for where is there, or which are the really good units where epidemiological research is being carried out, and get a job there if they can.
Can I ask one last question? I've known you well over the last 10 years because of your work in carrying out leading the fieldwork team in the Boyd Orr cohort, which I now work on. And you worked on this in between 1937 and 1939. What role did working on that study play in shaping your later career, if any?
It confirmed my conviction that epidemiology was an important way of looking at disease, and that the study of populations or disease in populations is a fascinating and important thing. I was at that stage, I was still interested in general clinical medicine, and in fact for several years afterwards I did work in clinical medicine, but within, I worked in the Department of Medicine in Sheffield, but the new professor after the war, he's a foresighted man, Stuart Harris, decided, I suppose he knew I was already working on social medicine, decided to have a lectureship within the Department of Medicine called lecturer or senior lecturer in medicine, bracket, social medicine, bracket. And so I, as it were, emerged from the womb of clinical medicine, and he allowed me to create a week's clerkship in social medicine. And that is when I organized for students to, well, I took them to coal mines, down coal mines, to steel factories, and organized them to go into patients' homes. And we organized sessions with clinicians on particular selected hospital patients. So, yes, I'm a bit off the point. How did the Boyd Orr survey influence me? Well, as I say, I think I've said it really. It showed me the possibilities and the experience of looking at a population, in this case children, and looking at some of the worst social conditions that could be found in the UK in 1939. So it was a great experience. Of course, I'm very delighted and gratified that the records we kept then have proved to be useful for further studies so many years later. Yes.
Thank you. No, that's fantastic.
I hope we've covered the ground. Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. An edited version of this interview was published in the July 2006 issue of the journal.